I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today on the Prosecutors, we follow up on our previous episodes, answer your questions, and read your emails. Everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. This is a weird one because Alice is sitting right next to me and I don't know what to do.
This is so awesome and bizarre and feels like we shouldn't be sitting in the same room.
What's going to be weird is when the audio is terrible and it turns out it's actually better or when
that
in the same room.
Or that our banter or rapport is worse when right. We're in the same room.
Exactly. Well, I didn't introduce you today, Alice. So here's my co-host, the irreplaceable, remarkable Alice.
Thanks, Brett. I really am excited to be here. It's been a long time coming to sit in the same room.
I know. It's amazing. So today we're going to do some follow-ups. We just finished with Ray Rivera yesterday. I hope you guys enjoyed that. We've already started to get a few emails about that. We'll follow up on Ray Rivera, though. Later. So plenty of time to get your Ray Rivera thoughts, comments, criticisms in. And if you want to do that, you can get us at Prosecutors Pod, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, prosecutorspod@gmail.com and prosecutorspodcast.com. And, you know, as evidenced by this very show, we will respond to what you say. And we will also read your emails live and in person. And in this case, together. So
exciting. And don't worry, we've asked all the people who sent us emails whether we can read it. So right. You can pour out your hearts to us in confidence if that's what you want.
Right. Some people asked us to leave certain parts out or, you know, not say their name. And obviously, we will always honor those requests. So the first case we want to talk about, the case we can never escape, Maura Murray. So Alice, I've been engaged in like a 10,000 tweet thread online. I know you've been trying to follow it. You may be having a little difficulty.
So can I defend myself for a second? I apparently have no idea how Twitter works. I cannot follow conversations. I try really hard, but I don't know how to read it sequentially. So that's part of my problem.
I don't think Twitter's meant to be understood. I think it's just meant to make people angry. It's like the ultimate source of confusion. But one thing I wanted to address that folks on Twitter have said several times, and we've actually talked about this with the guys for Missing Maura Murray, something that I've heard again and again and again is that there is no evidence that Maura Murray drove her car from UMass to New Hampshire, crashed it, and then abandoned it. And I guess there's this, I mean, I hate to call it a conspiracy theory because that's got a pejorative sense to it, but this notion that maybe somebody else killed her and they drove the car up there to dump it. And as I said, when you say you don't believe that, the retort is always there's no evidence. And I think this stems from sort of a fundamental misunderstanding about what evidence is. It's true that there's no direct evidence, but there's plenty of circumstantial evidence. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence.
Sorry, Brett, I chuckled just a little bit because you delivered a smackdown so nicely. So I'm sorry. I chuckled silently.
It was just a comment, just commenting. But no, I mean, look, it's a natural thing to not understand that. And circumstantial evidence gets a bad name. If you've ever seen a movie or watched Perry Mason or Law and Order, someone always says all you have is circumstantial evidence, as if that's somehow not enough or negative. And in reality, in court, circumstantial evidence has just as much strength as direct evidence. Direct evidence is just a witness. You know, if somebody can get on the stand and say, I saw X kill Y, that's direct evidence. But if you don't have that, but you have a gun with X's fingerprints on it, and you tested his hands, and it had gunpowder residue, and you have someone else who says, actually, this might be a little bit direct. Well, it's not really. Who says, he said, I hate Y, and I'm going to kill him. I'm going to go shoot him. You know, that's all circumstantial evidence that puts that person at the scene murdering Y. And on the basis of that, you can convict somebody. And I think one of the best examples I've heard of what circumstantial evidence is, imagine you're sitting in the lobby of a building and you can't see what's going on outside. And the door opens and somebody walks in and they're wearing a waterproof jacket and they're soaking wet and they're shaking out an umbrella. What is happening outside?
It's raining.
It's raining. And all of you just said that to your radios. But if this were a true crime discussion, someone would say, how do you know it was raining? Did someone see it raining? Do you have video of it raining? And that's the kind of thing you have with Mara Murray. Because there's no video of Mara on the side of that road. And other than Butch Atwood, there's no one who can put her there. And Butch didn't know her, so he can't identify her. In particular, people say there's no evidence. But that would be like saying there's no evidence that it's raining in that example.
And here's the point here. That's why in the court of law, when you go to trial, you have to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt, not 100% airtight, no possible other explanation. And that's because in real life, you don't often have direct evidence of every single point that you're trying to prove.
Right. We live our entire lives based on circumstantial evidence. You never for a second would think, I wonder if he went swimming in the fountain, or I wonder if a passing jet airliner dumped their waste container or whatever, and it just happened to land on him. Like, nobody would think that. You would think it's raining. And like Alice said, maybe that is what happened. Maybe he did go for a swim in the fountain. But if you're on the fountain team, you can't just assert, well, there's no proof. There's no proof it was raining, so maybe it was a fountain. In the face of that circumstantial evidence, you have to bring your own evidence. And we talk about burden shifting sometimes. And that really is how it works in a trial. You know, when evidence is presented, it's often incumbent on the other side to sort of rebut that evidence, particularly if you want to win. I mean, once again, in a criminal trial, you can always rely on reasonable doubt. But if one side presents a really good story and has evidence to back it up, you probably want to do something to rebut that. So just real quick, let's walk through all the circumstantial evidence that Mara Murray left UMass that day and drove to New Hampshire. She had researched places to stay in New Hampshire on her computer the day before and the day of. She had made phone calls looking for places to stay. She had printed out directions to Burlington, Vermont. She had taken her monkey with her. And we know she traveled with her monkey. She had taken all her money out of her savings account. We have video of that happening. She had stopped by to pick up accident forms, which means she was driving her Saturn that day. Those forms were found in her car. And given that the accident happened on a Saturday, I'm going to go ahead and say the DMV probably wasn't open on Sunday, so she probably did that on Monday. And she stopped at the liquor store to buy a bunch of liquor. Oh, and by the way, she had sent emails to her professors saying that she would be gone for a week. So, oh, and someone saw her leaving campus that day. So she definitely left campus. She definitely drove somewhere. Now,
and let's just say really quick right there, if we were in a trial and everything Brett just listed happened, we wouldn't spend any time in trial fighting about whether she left campus, unless for some reason the other side could present really convincing evidence that undercuts everything Brett just said. And I think the point is, there hasn't been any evidence that can undercut all of that circumstantial evidence that she, in fact, left UMass.
Now, if you want to say that at some point along the drive, she was intercepted by someone, that's a little bit more believable. But you still have some circumstantial evidence that she was on the side of the road that day. You have Butch Atwood, who said he saw a girl. Now, people push back on that because Mara always wore her hair up and her hair was down that day. So it couldn't have been Mara. And I would just note, she was just in a car wreck that resulted in her airbags deploying. She might not have been having the best hair day. I mean, I don't know what kind of ties she was using, but unless they're made out of like adamantium, I could imagine her hair falling out of her bun when you get in a car wreck when you're not wearing your seatbelt.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't know what to say about that, except even though I wear my hair up most days, there are times when my hair's down.
And maybe she was murdered and the female accomplice of the murderer, because presumably it wasn't a woman, Maura's body wasn't in the trunk. We don't have any evidence of that. And we don't know how this woman would have gotten rid of Maura's body. So maybe this is the female accomplice of the murderer who's driven the car and then wrecked the car and Butch misses her. Well, you still have the dogs. Now, the dogs didn't do a great job. They only traced her 100 yards, but they did track her. There is a hit on her. And it seems to indicate that Maura's scent traveled 100 yards down that road. It's not airtight. I think it's far less airtight than the fact that Maura drove her car away from UMass that day. But it's just not right to say that there's no evidence that Maura Murray was in Massachusetts that night. So the second thing we wanted to talk about, and we mentioned this in a previous follow-up, you guys out there are awesome. And those of you in the Maura Murray community are particularly awesome. And one of you went so far as to purchase a Saturn emblem and have it delivered to your house and then smashed it all up to see whether or not our theory that the paint chip on Patrice Vassy could have come from that emblem. And you may recall, we had speculated that Patrice Vassy may have been hit by Maura's Saturn. And people had said that the paint chip found on Patrice indicated that it wasn't her Saturn because her Saturn was black and the color of the paint chip was metallic silver, red, and white. And we pointed out that the emblem of a Saturn is red, metallic silver, and white. If you're watching this on YouTube, you are currently looking at a picture of a Saturn emblem, which has been smashed, and you are seeing silver, a white interior, and red. So I think we can go ahead and say that we have confirmed that the composite of a Saturn emblem is the three colors that were found on the paint chip on Patrice Vassy. Now, that does not mean that she hit Patrice Vassy, but it certainly means that while other things may rule her out, the paint chip does not.
And that's a really fine point that Brett just made. Maybe it's too lawyerly of a point, but all along we have said that the Patrice Vassy incident is possible, but not even likely. What we're saying here is that in the past, people have looked at the paint chip as evidence that there's no way Maura could have been involved. And all we're saying here is you can't rely on the paint chip to rule her out. Doesn't necessarily say that she did it. But that distinction is very important in court. So I just want to clarify that for anyone says, oh, you guys are crazy. There's no way Patrice Vassy is involved in Maura's case.
So I think that's all we have on Maura Murray. Do you have anything else you want to add?
Famous last words. Yeah. I'm pretty sure there will be more. Today, we're going to move on to other reader feedback.
And we love you, Maura Murray, guys. I mean, y'all have been fantastic. And so many of you started with Maura Murray and have listened to our other episodes and have stuck with us. And we really appreciate that. And we're always happy to hear any thoughts you have on that case or any other case. But moving all the way back to Elisa Lamb, which is the very first case that we ever covered, we received a great email. We had said that if there was anybody who had dealt with these kinds of mental issues, we had experienced it in our work, but we had never experienced it personally and can't really understand what it's like. And we did have somebody who wrote us a lengthy email about that. And so I am going to, do you want to read it?
Sure.
Alice is going to read it to you. They did ask to be anonymous, and obviously we are going to honor that.
Yes. So thank you to this reader for writing in and sharing their experience. This person writes, "Hey there, I just started listening to your podcast and am already a huge fan. Thank you so much. I wanted to reach out to y'all and share my thoughts on the Elisa Lamb case. In the second episode, Brett asked if there was anyone who has bipolar disorder who is willing to reach out and give their perspective on Elisa's behavior, specifically her actions in the elevator. I realize that that episode was a while ago, but I still want to share my thoughts if that's okay. You guys briefly mentioned the elevator game when talking about Elisa's bizarre demeanor on the security footage. I understand why you didn't spend much time reflecting on that as a possibility for why she died, because you are producing a crime podcast, not a paranormal horror podcast. However, I want to offer my thoughts on how the elevator game may indeed have caused some of her behavior. I have bipolar disorder type 1 with psychotic features, and my analysis is based on my experience with that. When I first heard about this case on another podcast, the elevator game was discussed in detail. One aspect of bipolar disorder, as I experience it, is that I am more open-minded and creative than other people, particularly when I'm manic. I'm more willing to believe things that are out there or abnormal. The validity of the elevator game is neither here nor there, but I certainly am interested in that realm and would probably be more likely to attempt to play it than neurotypical people. I personally believe that Elisa may have been trying to play the game, which would explain her bizarre behavior on the security footage. I'm not trying to say that that's why she died. It's just a theory as to why she was acting that way. Given the fact that she was not taking her meds correctly, she may have tried to play the game and experienced some psychosis or confusion. I'm sorry for the long message. I just wanted to offer my thoughts. Thank you both for discussing Elisa and bipolar disorder with compassion and without judgment or blame. That dignified position toward mental illness is not very common these days. So thank you so much to that reader or to that listener for that very thoughtful explanation from his or her perspective of bipolar disorder. And, you know, we discussed this during the Elisa episodes, but you know, we really did think that Elisa was acting in a childlike, playful manner. And if she were playing this game, I think it would comport with some sort of game that she thinks she's playing rather than something more malicious.
Yes, I think that fits perfectly with what we thought had happened. And thank you so much to this listener for writing us. And don't ever apologize about writing a long message. We love hearing from you guys and your insights are so great. You know, we are prosecutors, we are lawyers. Most of the stuff we do, it's not us doing all the work. It's the witnesses, right? I mean, that's who people want to hear from. They don't actually care about our opinion. And so in a lot of these cases, if we have folks who have information, we want to get that out as much as possible. And also thank you for the comments about how we handled mental illness, because we did want to do that without judgment and with compassion.
And, you know, we've mentioned this before, and Elisa's case is not the last case we'll deal with where mental illness probably played a role. And in our cases, in our, you know, experience as prosecutors, mental illness, unfortunately, plays a prominent role in many of our cases. And it's difficult to understand. And we want to make sure, and we do this in our day jobs too, we want to make sure that we offer that compassion, because I can't imagine what it must be like to live with a lot of these mental disorders.
So the next case we have some comments on are Aunt Diane. And a couple people suggested some stuff related to kind of the mystery of what all was going on in that case. We talked about, and Alice talked about, how hard it would be to hide smoking marijuana from your kids in the car. One person suggested that she could have eaten an edible, and that's how the THC got in her body. I think that's possible. I would think that would have shown up in her stomach contents during the autopsy, but maybe not. My big question would be, I know, you know, marijuana is basically legal now, so you can get edibles everywhere, but were edibles readily available in the New York area at that time?
I don't know. And also, she was camping, so she wouldn't have had an oven to bake like a brownie. And so she'd probably have to bring it with her. And I do have to note, one person, one listener had said, like, do little kids really know what a blunt looks like? I don't know about y'all, but my toddler picks up on everything. And if I had a smoking thing, like something that had smoke coming out of it, oh my gosh, there would be nonstop questions about what's that? What's that? Why is it red? Is it fire? So maybe they wouldn't have noticed it in terms of knowing that it was a blunt, but I do think kids would notice. And one of the nieces was 7. And so I just put that out there that I don't know about you guys, but my toddler will ask questions as long as the day is long.
Now, one thing I don't know is, did she smoke cigarettes? If she smoked cigarettes, then maybe they were used to that and it wasn't that big a deal. Somebody else said that when she stopped on the side of the road, she was probably smoking when she was outside the van and concealing it by bending over. And they suggested that they knew that from experience. So that was another possibility. It is a mystery to me, because just what Alice said, I think kids would pick up on that. So we have another email. This is from...
Wait, I'm really excited about this. Can I just say, this person just takes the cake because they had the best signature I've seen. So Brett, Who is this next letter from? Yeah,
and pay attention out there. This is from number one prosecutee.
I love it.
Somebody make shirts.
Thank you, number one prosecutee.
Yes, thank you, number one prosecutee. And this person writes, thanks for your great episode on Aunt Diane. I'd watched the documentary a while ago, but didn't think I realized how much THC she had in her system or that it was apparently so recent. So here's my theory. I think the mixing of the two has a lot to do with it. Even if she regularly had one for the road, surely she wasn't smoking in the car before. Anyone would have smelled it if she had. I actually think that the there's something wrong with Aunt Diane comment probably came around the time she was smoking. I mean, I've been around people who were smoking pot before. Smoking it looks weird, not like a cigarette, which I guess that just contradicts what I just said. And it stinks bad. Just imagine what an 8-year-old would think if her aunt lit up a joint behind the wheel of the car and she's acting weird to boot. It seems like something that would definitely freak out an 8-year-old. So I think maybe the combined effects did her in, but here's my guess. I think she might have been in pain, stressed, harried, and or tired, and under the combined influence. I guess she could have thought everybody else was making a mistake and kept going, but I think it might have been more. I think she might have had a delusion or a hallucination, or maybe even something that struck her as a moment of clarity in her impairment and just made sense in her altered mind that she needed to drive like a determined bat out of hell the wrong way. You all talked about how it didn't seem like she was out of control, swerving, but rather she was driving competently with purpose. That's why I think it was a hallucination or delusion owing to her intoxication. Something was driving her to do it. Kind of like Brett's theory about Elisa Lam, that everything she did that led to her getting into the water tower made perfect sense to her at the time. We may never know exactly what logic reigned at that moment. Here, not because of mental illness or pharmacological side effects, but rather intoxication, but it did. So that's my theory. Keep it up with a great podcast. Do the staircase. Can't wait to hear what you have to say about those jokers at the trial. Who is she referring to?
I don't know who she's referring to. We crack ourselves up way too much.
Oh, we do. But I just got to tell you, number one prosecutee, you're going to be excited about next week's episode.
All right. Yeah, I'm excited about next week's episode. Who else might be?
Who might we be covering that day? Anyways, sorry.
Never apologize for a fantastic pun.
I know you love puns.
Prosecutee. That's the best pun of all time.
That's amazing.
Oh, yes. Gosh.
Sorry.
No. That I think, I like that theory a lot. I think it jives with kind of what we discussed in the episode. And especially the comment about lighting up the blunt at the same time that the niece is making the comments there's something wrong with Aunt Diane makes a lot of sense too. Right. Maybe she may not know what exactly is wrong, but she hasn't seen something like a blunt being lit up in the car.
And that goes along with what you were just saying. So I think that does make a lot of sense.
I'm right sometimes, Brett.
Do you want to read from Michelle, our prosecutor from New York?
All right. So what is really fun, I will say, is hearing from other prosecutors and other attorneys. So thank you all attorneys out there who have been listening to us and sending us really encouraging emails. We'd like to read one from Michelle, who is a prosecutor from New York. She writes, on a more serious note, this was something I learned from my former unit chief of vehicular crimes in the city that has always stuck with me, and I love sharing it. He got us into the practice of saying collision in place of accident, whether it be in conversation with him, in court, in motion papers, in plea memos, etc. The term accident implies no fault. So he trained us to say collision to describe a wreck because it was a more neutral term that lent itself to an understanding that further investigation was needed. I'll stop there for a second. I think that's a great, great point.
That is a great point.
Yeah, thank you. Michelle, for pointing out how terms can really affect people's thinking of a situation. The Schuler collision occurred in an area that my boyfriend and I are familiar with from driving upstate to go hiking. There was another case similar yet very different than this that occurred on Long Island on July 2nd, 2005. Martin Hedgen had been drinking all day. He left a friend's party at 2 a.m. without anyone noticing. Got into his car and eventually made his way to the Meadowbrook Parkway, driving the wrong direction on the 3-lane curvy parkway until he collided with a limo carrying a family returning from a wedding reception. The driver and a 7-year-old flower girl were killed on impact. The remaining adults in the limo were seriously injured. The issue on appeal was whether the defendant was too intoxicated to have formed the proper mens rea. Mens rea is state of mind, to sustain a verdict of murder in the second under a depraved indifference theory. This argument was hotly debated in New York at the time, as the four different appellate divisions in the state were at odds over what constituted depraved indifference under New York law. The Hedgin case, along with the two other cases heard on appeal, finally appeared to put that argument to rest when the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York, upheld the verdict and the lower court's ruling that Hedgin had indeed been able to formulate the culpable mental state to continue driving on the parkway. This piece of evidence was the clincher. The limo he crashed into it had a camera, which showed that moments before the crash, as Stanley, the driver, tried to move the limo out of the path of Hedgin's car, one could see the headlights of the car staying with the limo and moving with the limo, keeping the limo in its path. Additionally, other witnesses testified that Hedgin was driving approximately 70 to 80 miles per hour, he never hit the brakes, and never slowed down during his wrong-way drive. Also, his BAC was 0.28, taken from a blood draw after he was transported to the hospital. His friends who saw him at the party said he didn't seem that intoxicated, though. This caused so much uproar on Long Island, where your primary way of getting around is by car, and the island has seen its fair share of drunk driving collisions and arrests. Hedgin is still incarcerated, and in my opinion, rightfully so. And then she links to the decision that we just discussed.
And we'll put that decision on the internet, and you guys can debate in the comments why the Supreme Court of New York is not called the Supreme Court of New York, but the Supreme Court of New York is actually an inferior court to the Court of Appeals.
It's just to confuse us. And they're not the only state that does this, by the way. So Michelle goes on to say, lastly, I wanted to touch on something that Alice said near the end of the episode. Being a female prosecutor in what is still considered a male-dominated profession is still a challenge, even in 2020. Even at my last job where the male-female ratio was almost equal in numbers, there's still this old-fashioned sexism that runs through the bar where certain older male attorneys think that it's okay to call me sweetie, honey, or by my first name. Parentheses, we're not friends, and you can call me an ADA. Take papers off my table in court without asking or try to bully me into plea deals or other nonsense. Unfortunately for the bullies, I spent 10 plus years working in the city, spending time in police precincts and detective squads, and I do not have time for bullshit. It happens less often since I left New York City for a job at the Suffolk District Attorney's Office on Long Island. If you've ever heard of, is it Gilgo?
Gilgo Beach.
Gilgo yes. Beach, then you know my jurisdiction. But still, I feel that pressure to work harder and be better than some of my older male counterparts, or at least have my guard up. That being said, I work on long-term financial investigations and money laundering cases now, so my time is spent more in my office and working with my chief than in court. And I am so fortunate to be working for an amazing group of attorneys in Suffolk County. Michelle, thank you for writing about so much of your experience with this Diane Shuler case and also your ending comment about some of the sexism that we still see in the prosecutor world. And thank you for sharing your experience. Maybe someone else out there and they're going through the same thing, and your encouragement is what they needed to hear today. And I have to say, Michelle, your experience is consistent with mine. I don't go looking for sexism, but certainly I've been called sweetie in court. I've never heard a male prosecutor be called a sweetie. Although I'm now going to call Brett a prosecutee, so there's that. Yeah, so thank you for sharing your experience.
And Michelle, if we ever do the Long Island serial killer, we'll have to have you on. That may be a violation of your confidentiality agreements with your office, but everybody's going to want to know if you have any information on what was going on Gilgo Beach back when that killer was active. But yeah, thank you. And we actually have another email from Michelle later on that we'll talk about.
I love your thoughts, Michelle, by the way. So thank you.
Yeah. Michelle's awesome.
She is.
Yeah. Probably way better prosecutor than we are.
Probably. Don't tell her. Don't tell her office.
I'll cut that out. Brian Schaefer. So one person doesn't like that we always consider aliens at the beginning of our missing person cases. I think they felt like maybe we were trivializing these disappearances and these tragedies. And I totally understand that. I just got to say, we get depressed in these cases. I don't know if y'all noticed, but by the end of some of these, we're like really kind of Eeyoring through. So we got to kind of interject a little bit of humor. I mean, this is not a comedy true crime podcast. I always think it's weird that they're a comedy true crime podcast, though they're great, you know. A lot of people really love those, but just interjecting a little humor.
Also, not only the humor part. I think partly the reason we bring up UFOs and aliens is when we're saying, like, we have no idea what happened. Anything could happen. And that's just kind of a placeholder for the absolute unknown to us. And so we're not trying to trivialize these cases because, you know, we do spend a lot of time researching these cases and talking about these cases before we ever record. And, you know, these are real people to us, just as they are, in fact, real people, real lives are involved. So if you think that we're trivializing, we apologize, but that is not our intent whatsoever.
So Jenny Danielle, who is a private investigator, and she's an awesome private investigator based on the information she's already dug up on some of our cases. So if you guys need a private investigator, she's available on Twitter. So
she's
check
her
out. So she, after hearing our episodes, looked into some stuff on Brian Schaefer, particularly on the phone ping. And I'm just going to read you the information that she sent us. So she says,
Brett, this is such good information.
I know, it's amazing. And I just want to return to this. I told somebody on the Maura Murray Reddit that if there were people following the Brian Schaefer case the way they follow Maura Murray, there would be like a full diagram of the bar with every exit marked and every camera with like paragraph long description of exactly what that camera saw that night. And there's just not, that's just, we don't have that in Brian Schaefer. And so it's really great to have Jenny kind of pull some of this information. So she says on the phone ping, couple things. Number one, it didn't just ring the one time. It rang several times for both Alexis and others. It rang from 11:30 p.m. on Friday night to Saturday morning. After listening to Sergeant John Hurst and the Comeback podcast, which we recommended, and then the Brian Schaefer Dead or Alive podcast, which I actually haven't heard, I came to the conclusion that what Sergeant John Hurst is explaining and what we think he is talking about are two different things. And this is really interesting. How he describes pinging the phone lines or the phone lines up with how law enforcement would do a real-time ping on a phone. I think technically on a phone without GPS, it would be called call triangulating, but it's the same thing essentially. A real-time ping can be sent out by law enforcement or the carrier in exigent circumstances like a missing person case. The laws are much more strict on this now than they were back in 2006, and that's definitely true. So Alexis calling law enforcement to say the phone is ringing and multiple people heard the phone ring would most likely trigger either law enforcement to get permission from Singular to do the pings slash triangulation or just do it on their own. So maybe after Alexis triggers the pings, law enforcement tries, and it only captures cell tower locations one or two times because the phone has been switched back off. This is completely different from obtaining the location information from a CDR, call detail record. A CDR will list all of the tower locations that a phone finds and uses each time a call slash text message is sent or received on a phone. So, since they only were able to get the one or two pings, it leads me to believe law enforcement is talking about actually what happened when they or the carrier sent out the signal trying to triangulate the phone or locate one tower. Because Brian's phone had no GPS, they would just be locating towers or trying to triangulate rather than the location of the towers that were located each time the phone rang that weekend. And obviously that's really interesting because once again, if law enforcement was able to ping his phone, it makes you think.
It was on. It had battery.
It had battery.
Someone had to turn it on because they weren't able to do it before, and then it was turned off. And those typically don't happen by themselves. Or if a phone was charged and then ran out of battery, probably wouldn't run out that quickly.
You know, the thing I kind of wondered, and we talked a little bit about this at the time, but let's say, you know, we talked about water. Let's say the cell phone had been in water and dropped the cell phone in water, it stops working. And at some point, the cell phone, you know, washes up on the shore somewhere and dries out. If maybe when it dried out, it temporarily went back to being active again until the battery ran out or something like that.
Have you ever dropped your phone or any electronic in water?
I mean, I have.
Especially if it's submerged.
You put it in the rice and it gets the moisture out.
But it's typically not when it's been submerged in water for months. Or
that's
even
true.
The only time the rice trick has worked for me is I'm trying to think. I think I dropped it in the sink and it was not submerged. It like hit water on the majority of the phone, and I quickly turned it off so it wouldn't short, stuck it in a bag of rice to dry it out, and kept it there for like a week, and then turned it back on and it did not work. So it was not submerged in, say, like a lake. It can work in some instances, but it's hard to believe that it can be underwater for potentially months and then dry out on its own and have enough battery life to turn on to ping.
So my last Samsung phone, which has a guarantee that it's like water resistant, uh-huh. whatever. So not being paid by Samsung, but I actually had it in my pocket when I went into the pool. I like walked into the pool with my phone.
And did it work still?
And then I realized at some point, like, shoot, my phone's in my pocket. And I pulled it out and it worked. It was on and everything.
Wow.
It was
still on.
But the one thing that happened to it, and obviously this has no bearing on Brian Schaefer because his phone is completely different, was you could no longer charge it with a plug. So you had to do the like
you put it on top wireless, of the whatever thing.
Yeah, charging. I had to get a wireless charger. But anyways, no, I think you're right. And look, I think people have dismissed this ping for far too long. I think this ping is a really weird piece of evidence and an already
based on
really
what Jenny
case.
Says, I don't think we can dismiss the ping. And it's much more I think there's much more to be looked into there.
And I think one of the sort of amazing things about this case, this is the only case where nobody's like yelled at us for the conclusions we reached because nobody has any idea. You know, like one person was like aliens or the world's greatest April Fool's joke. Like, I don't know. I mean, this one's crazy and I don't know what to say about it. I have no idea what happened. It's just a complete mystery.
Every time I think I might know the answer, I'm thrown for a loop, and it's like one of the most frustrating cases to think about. It's like banging your head on a wall.
Yeah, and I just believe, and I'll always believe, that some piece of information, common knowledge out there, is wrong. And I just wish I knew which piece of information that was, but hopefully one day we'll find out what happened to Brian Schaefer. And Michelle has an email about Brian, so... Do you want to read Michelle's?
Yeah, sure. I'll read at least half of it because, Michelle, you just have some wonderful thoughts on this. So she writes about the Brian episode. Excellent episode on Brian's story. As soon as you guys said back room, I immediately thought of Twin Peaks, The Black Lodge, which Dr. Shiloh of LA Not So Confidential podcast and Lance from Missing Maura Murray and I are obsessed with. But I never thought of Alice's theory, parentheses, trapped in the wall, until she brought it up on the episode and I found it fascinating. Broadly speaking, I don't think Brian is alive and I don't think he was murdered. I believe his disappearance was the product of a series of unfortunate events. One thought I have had when listening or reading about this case, there is a lot of emphasis on Brian not being seen on the surveillance cameras. What if he didn't walk out on his own, but it was instead concealed in something, like a container and removed from the bar at another time, i.e. a portion of the video where the police or the rest of us pondering this case would not have thought to concentrate on? Here's an example. 19-year-old Kenya Mongi
sounds good to me.
went missing on April 1st, 2011, after a night of drinking and dancing at a club in downtown Denver, Colorado. 31-year-old Travis Forbes, a local entrepreneur who specializes in baking all-natural granola bars, gave her – that's awesome. Very Denver – gave her a ride home. So he said. Turns out, Forbes murdered Kenya in his van. He was renting a space at a local bakery to make his granola bars. The night Kenya vanishes, he unplugged one of the video cameras that was trained on the freezer. He failed, however, to realize that there was another camera in the room, and police retreated to the site of Forbes pushing a cooler into the freezer that night, then removing it the following day and burying Kenya's body in a field that he eventually led police to when he was arrested. This is all to say that what if Brian met some accidental fate inside the bar and was discovered by an employee or employees after closing time or the next morning, was placed into a cooler or receptacle large enough to hold his body and carted out of the bar at a time where the sight of employees moving something out of the bar would not catch the eye of someone watching the surveillance video? I'm going to stop there for a second and discuss that.
Sure. I mean, look, I'm open to any possibilities in this case.
My one problem with this is the employees, if they had nothing to do with the death, why put yourself at criminal in fear of criminal prosecution for like hiding it? It just you know, obviously if you're hiding a body or disposing of a body, even if you had nothing to do with the death, is a crime.
It would almost have to be like the owner, right? And I am not accusing the owner of killing Brian, but if you're just making up a scenario where, I mean, we know the Ugly Tuna closed at some point. I think it's now under new ownership. The margins at bars are small. Probably can't afford a wrongful death lawsuit if you're the owner of a bar. So I'd almost think it would have to be somebody that had some sort of vested interest like that, or like Al said, actually murdered him. But like I said, I'm open to anything. I would think that the police would have looked for that kind of thing in the days following video of someone taking out a container large enough to house a body. We know that they looked at video of the band for that very reason, because they wanted to make sure they didn't take him out in the drum kit or something like that. I don't know. I know I've already said I don't know, but I don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, while we're on this email, I wanted to correct something. I went back and looked at it after the podcast came out. The New Haven case that I was talking about, the girl who was put into the medical school walls, her name is Annie Lay, if you guys are interested in reading more about it. And I think on the podcast, I said that it was a long time later that they found her body. And at the time, I really did think it was almost a semester. I went back and looked at the facts, and she was discovered 4 days later. And the reason I bring this up is when you are living this trauma and this drama, it does feel like a lifetime. And I remember those 4 days feeling like it was the entire semester. And I almost can't believe that it was only 4 days. And this actually goes back to something that Brett and I have talked about a lot in past episodes. Memory is really faulty. Even if it's your personal experience, it is faulty, and it's really difficult to rely on memories, eyewitness testimony. And you just got an experience of that from me. I think I'm a pretty educated person, and I lived through that particular experience, and I thought it was months, not 4 days.
Right. And that's why I think people are beginning to realize this more and more. If you do have an eyewitness or whatever, you really need some kind of other evidence to back it up.
Hey, imagine that. Direct evidence might not be your best evidence, Brett.
It's crazy. It's crazy that maybe.
Are you saying you might need circumstantial evidence to corroborate your direct evidence?
Well, it's like, you know, all the people on the Butch Atwood thing, and Butch Atwood, did he see Maura? Butch Atwood says Maura was wearing a jacket. He remembers her wearing a dark jacket, but on the ATM footage, she's wearing a light jacket. So some people are like, see, it was a different person because different colored jacket. I mean, I couldn't tell you what I wore yesterday. I couldn't tell you what my wife is wearing right now.
So you better hope she doesn't go missing and you have to describe her to the police.
Exactly.
But I only brought that up because I think that I'm above that kind of misremembering of things. And I was just shocked myself at how off I was.
Yeah. And then I love the next part of Michelle.
Yeah, why don't you read the
email? Because I feel the same way about this. She says, now for the asshole elephant in the room, the smiley face killer. It pains me that this disgusting predatory theory came out of my home state and city where I used to work. It's not real. And frankly, it makes me so effing angry. Censored that for the kids, that it even exists because it gives families of the missing and deceased this false hope that something other than an accident, nature or fate, led to the deaths or disappearances of their loved ones. It's cruel and predatory and not real, and I despise it with every bone in my being. Those are some very strong feelings, Michelle, on the smiley face killer. I agree. I think the smiley face killer is a ridiculous theory. You kind of touched on that a little bit. And it's even worse than what Michelle says, because sometimes these people actually were murdered, but it takes investigation off potential murderers to this imaginary cult of killers who love smiley faces.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that that commentary, Michelle, and I agree.
So that's all we have from you guys this time. Keep sending those emails, comments, questions, tweets, things on YouTube. You guys are fantastic. We've gotten so much from you guys. I mean, we could just read YouTube comments all day long, or I could just read the entirety of that Twitter thread, Alice, and then you would know.
And then I would know what's happening.
But yeah, and I think I will say one thing about that Twitter thread. I think it's a really good example of how if people can come together on these cases with you know, goodwill and working together and keeping an open mind, I do think we can make some headway. And I think the vast majority of people on that thread, that's exactly how they're approaching it. So I am enjoying it and I will continue to be active on that. So I think that's all we have for today. Alice, do you have anything else?
No, thank you guys for writing. We truly love reading your thoughts because we don't think that we have all the answers at all.
Yeah, and these follow-up episodes are so easy because we just read what you say. So it requires absolutely no preparation whatsoever on our part. So keep it up. But that's it for today. Next week, we will have a new case.
Please keep listening.
Yes. But I think you're all going to enjoy it. It's got everything you want.
It's got some of the best outakes exist in life. You Amazing should tune outtakes. In just for the outtakes.
Make sure you listen to the entire episode. There's four of them, so all four of them. And, you know, I keep reading people online saying that they wish we talked more about the law. It's crazy. I don't understand you people.
You guys are awesome and a little strange.
Yeah, a little strange, but we load you up. These next four episodes, man, you will be a lawyer.
It is a treatise. You can try your own criminal case after these next episodes.
Yeah. But we'll see you then. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors.
This is my normal voice. How is it in terms of the volume?
A little bit louder.
A little louder.
That was too loud.
I'll talk louder, maybe a little less loud.
That's perfect. Do it like that.
I'm going to talk like this.
That's perfect. If you talk like that, we'll be great.
No pressure.
No pressure. No pressure. Don't worry about it. Just ignore the ignore the little green lines.
I'm ignoring.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.